everyone, to Season 2 of IDEA, the podcast about improving data engagement and advocacy. We are your hosts, Brianna Wham.
And Shannon Sheridan. And we've got a very fresh article for you today. It was published just in September of 2023. So the title is The Effects of Research Data Management Services, Associating the Data Curation Lifecycle with Open Research Output. It was published in College and Research Libraries, and the authors are Nicholas Pears and Peter Organishak, and they are both at the University of Denver.
And overall, this article seeks to answer a particular problem statement. So they're trying to look at, does institutional research data management services framed in the stages of the data curation lifecycle, and in particular here, they're referencing the DCC lifecycle, does this affect the researcher's ability and sense of importance for producing open and shareable research data? So basically, do research data management services at an institution affect the ability and desire of a researcher to produce open data? And how does the workflow for how those are presented to researchers impact their overall outcome for open data sharing?
Yeah, and this was actually a very nicely organized article, like in terms of looking at what they were trying to figure out was very clear. They focused their research on two different questions, specifically that they were trying to answer with their survey. So the first was, do institutional contexts, such as location of RDM services, availability of RDM services, and institutional roles, affect researchers' ability and sense of importance to produce shareable and open primary research data? And then their second question was, do institutional services framed in the stages of the data lifecycle affect researchers' ability and sense of importance to produce shareable and open primary research data? So they're looking at two separate things here, institutional context in general, like where the services live, and then also, as Brianna mentioned in that problem statement, framing that context of services in the data lifecycle, if that has any impact on that open sharing of data.
They also do a really great job in the introduction and providing the background or context for which service offerings are provided. And in particular, they reference the OCLC service model, which actually I had not been extremely familiar with before this. And so I appreciated that this model actually highlights three types of service models, breaking it down into education. So educating researchers and other stakeholders on the importance, and in some cases, the necessity of responsibly managing their data and making arrangements for its long-term curation. Expertise, which is in this case defined as providing decision support and customized solutions for researchers working through specific RDM problems, as well as curation support, supplying technical infrastructure and related services that support data management throughout the research cycle. And this is relevant, and one of the reasons I think Shannon and I both wanted to kind of include that in the podcast here today is that they specifically are looking at kind of where and how services are being offered. And so by kind of referencing previous approaches and models for which service offerings touch on is relevant in this case, since they're also looking at not just libraries as providers, but research support across an institution.
And I thought it was interesting because they argued that libraries only fit into one of the types of service models. They don't specify, but if I had to guess, it would probably be the education, because I know we do a lot in the library world with education and outreach. Although I would think that would greatly depend on your institution, because I do know that there are places that do provide things like expertise and curation for their researchers. A lot of that depends on, you know, how many people are there, where that area of expertise lies. So it's very much not uniform as an expectation across institutions. But I do think it's worth mentioning that sometimes it can be all three service models.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. And I think it's interesting to think through. And I think that maybe it's not got it in this article, but the idea of, you know, RDM services exist at institutions in various places. And depending on the institution, as you said, its size, scope, where certain expertise or services lie can differ greatly just based off of that institution's organization and setup.
Definitely. So to answer these questions, the authors used a survey questionnaire that had 14 questions, and these questions were crafted to reflect the stages of the DCC data curation lifecycle model stages. So like Brianna mentioned earlier, that was the model they were using to answer that question of if services framed in such a lifecycle model affect a researcher's interest in publishing open data. Now, it was a survey that was administered during the pandemic, which the authors point out as a potential confounding factor, because there was a lot going on and the services have changed since then, but they do mention that. They had a really good spread of geographic responses across North America, coast to coast, north to south, and even had a couple of Canadian institutions, so our neighbors to the north, which I was really impressed by. And the study was targeted at both researchers who have used or have knowledge of their institution's RDM services and the RDM specialists that were providing support. It wasn't a huge study population. They only had 46 respondents, and a little under half of those were researchers. And one of the ways that they got open responses, they put out a call on several LIS listservs.
That's exactly right. So they used listservs, primarily, as you said, LIS or library listservs. And then they also mentioned that they actually did individual contacts, or so reached out individually to some people in order to make sure that they could get that broad geographic extent and institutions to get responses to their survey. However, one thing that I would like to know more about is how did they select those individuals? Were they primarily also librarians or research data management specialists in libraries at these institutions? Were these the researchers? And also, how were they selecting institutions? Were they trying to broaden the type of institution that's included?
Yeah, a little bit more clarity there, I think, would have been helpful, because I think the population matters when you're surveying for questions like this, because if you're not getting the audience that has knowledge, then it makes it harder to draw firm conclusions.
That's exactly right. And they did mention, which I think is interesting, that a little under half of the respondents were researchers, but we also aren't clear on what discipline were those researchers coming from. Were they all from a few institutions, or were the researchers also broadly distributed and distributed across institution types? So that's something that I'd be interested in knowing, because I could imagine researchers themselves might differ in response to questions such as those posed in this, and I'm sure we'll get into that more, but also researchers and research support specialists might answer questions differently.
And I will note that they do have the questionnaire as an appendix to their article, but it does not appear that the survey results are available. At least we couldn't find it on the article itself. So, you know, making that data openly available might make answering those types of questions easier, because we would be able to see them.
One thing I was excited to see in this article is that because of how they set up their kind of study, they were prepared to run statistics. So for all of their research questions, they actually have set up the survey where they can have multiple independent variables related to their dependent variable, looking at is their interest and action around open data sharing and ability. And so they actually were able to run chi-squares looking at these questions overall to see if there's statistically a difference.
Yes. And we, because we like to be thorough, we're going to run through the research questions where they did find an association between a couple of different factors. And so we thought that was pretty exciting.
Yeah. And I can kick that off, Shannon.
Yeah, go for it.
They were looking at whether there was an association between location and the importance of sharing research data. And what they found was that when services are located at the library, they are associated with that sentiment that sharing research data is more important.
The next one was that there was an association between location and ability. So the association of services at the library had a relationship with the researcher's ability to publish that open data.
They also found an association between the availability and importance. So when services are made available, there is an association with that kind of sentiment that sharing research data is important.
And then finally, there was an association between education and importance. So when there was research data management education available, that had a relationship with the belief in the importance of open data and sharing research. And all of those four associations that we just went over, they tied them all to that research question number one about institutional contexts affecting the sense of importance for producing open research data.
Exactly. And they also then break down their results looking at question two, so looking at impact of associating your services with the research data lifecycle. And the first association they found here was between support and services across the research data lifecycle. And so here, what they found was that there was a relationship between access to services at each stage and those services supporting the production of open and publishable research data.
And then the only other question for research question number two about the lifecycle model that they were answering that had an association was the association between services helping the development of data management plans and its association with support of open data and shareable research. So basically, if there were services or education around researchers creating data management plans, they saw a pretty strong association with that support for open data.
And that's good to see, given, you know, as somebody that offers data management plan support, and also with all the new policies, at least in the US, that are coming out, requiring the creation of data management plans as a means to advance open data and open research.
Yeah, and I think sliding right into the discussion point here, this was actually one of the associations that they highlighted both there and in their discussion section as a really good potential avenue for getting researchers more interested in sharing open data, because I think that was one of the strongest associations. So that's worth noting. And as I said, they did pull that out in their discussion section about data management plans as a promising practice for encouraging researchers to promote open data.
You know, Shannon, I'd be intrigued to see, and I feel this way about many of their questions, but in particular, this one, intrigued to see if there's a difference between researcher responses and research support specialist responses with regards to the value of data management plans, particularly as somebody that offers these services. I often hear folks mention that, you know, data management plan that they're having to draft for a proposal is an administrative burden at times, or maybe not really useful as a tool in the current state that it's kind of drafted in. So as somebody who, I agree, I think that data management plans can be extremely useful, and they do outline a protocol for open data sharing and shareable research. I know there's a lot of studies on how researchers see data management plans, how often are they used. And so I'd be interested to see if there was a distinction in responses there between researchers and research support specialists.
Yeah, that would be interesting, because I've heard the same about, I think we all have, with the administrative burden. So my institution, being primarily research focused, they tend to be very large research projects. You know, they've got multiple thrusts. Sometimes they're a multi-institution. Obviously, the same thing happens at universities as well. And so one of the things that I've really started pushing is, like, yes, you have to write a data management plan as part of your grant application. Like, that's just, it's the new norm. But there's a lot of value in taking that plan and then developing it further as like an actual document to use during research. And I've had a couple of instances where, you know, researchers that didn't have a data management plan, when we really started helping them develop workflows or like curation plans, they start wanting to write those down because they're working with so many large teams that it's pretty critical to have a record of what's been done to data, who's doing the data. And so it's a little linguistically difficult because that is also their data management plan, not referring to, you know, the two-pager that they're sending in with their grant application. But I think sometimes framing it like that, maybe we can start to get over that hurdle of like, oh, this is just another piece of paper that I have to write to get my money.
Yeah, and I think it goes to also that culture shift of having researchers see the practices associated with research data management as standard practices of research, which I think many do, but it's not always as integrated into it as things like hypothesis testing, or you have your standard operating procedures for running an RNA extraction or DNA extraction or something. That's very standard in many research projects. And I think, as you just said, translating the funder data management plan narrative into something more similar to a procedures document for a research team or research project is really the value.
And I think we've kind of seen that with the data curation lifecycle. Like, I feel like that's kind of been our field's response to creating an operating procedure. Because it does, you know, there's a lot of flavors of those life cycles out there. And that was one of the interesting things about the survey is that they didn't really yield any significant associations between a researcher's ability to produce open research and applying the stages of the data curation life cycle to it. And they did mention that this needs to be analyzed further because there's probably other factors that are motivating a researcher's ability to produce that open data that goes beyond the availability of services for every stage of the life cycle. But that was, I think, you know, one of their big takeaways, that it doesn't seem like the existence of the life cycle and researchers' knowledge of it and having services applied to each of those model stages really has a lot of impact. So some other possible variables they mentioned could be incentives, personal motivation, technology needs. And I found this interesting because it made me wonder if, like, the lack of services at each stage don't actually influence what gets shared. And maybe it really is just those other outside motivating factors.
Yeah, I also wonder how much researchers consider the data life cycle. I know, as somebody that came from biology background into the libraries, I had not actually heard of the research data life cycle until joining the libraries. Now, the phases are very relevant. You know, I had phases to my research practice. And so I do wonder if some of that comes from data life cycles differ by type of research, potentially even by research group. And so I think where I personally see more value in the research data life cycle is in that idea of organization of services to make it easier for researchers to find services relevant to where they might be at, but they might not call that phase the same thing. So that's where I think it's interesting that they found this result here, because it does suggest, like, should we be thinking differently about how we organize and make our services more accessible and visible to researchers?
And they also found, I think equally interesting, was that location sometimes can matter. And so, you know, as we kind of mentioned going over those research questions, their study found that when those research data management services are located at the library, they have a stronger association with producing that shareable research and open data. They didn't look specifically into why, but they did mention, you know, the history of libraries is cross-departmental, our very wonderful advocacy and awareness abilities that I think a lot of us have, or just skills and a infrastructure that's convenient for that kind of work. But, you know, they were big proponents of the library there.
Yeah, I am very interested by that result, though I'm hesitant to interpret too much from it, given that it seems like their survey respondents were probably from or related to libraries. So either they were within the libraries themselves, or they've used library services. And so I think it's accurate that many of these services exist in libraries. And when folks are aware of them, they see the value that libraries can offer. And libraries do have a lot of expertise in this space. And as was mentioned, a major benefit of the libraries is that they're typically centrally located. They're not a compliance office. It's a safe space where folks can come to get support and service. And they usually have a education and training mission, as well as a mission for open information. So it's directly relevant for kind of this open data. They have experience with metadata and organization, which is all related to research data management. But I'm hesitant to interpret this result particularly too strongly when most of their respondents were from the libraries.
Yeah, and I will say we don't know that specifically because they don't break it into demographics, but the fact that they really only use library listservs in their open call for survey respondents is what I think is leading both Brianna and I to be like, well, yes, 80% of the respondents identified RDM services at the library, But if you're basically only using library listservs to get respondents, that's kind of a natural bias, I think, that would emerge. But it might, I mean, it might be, like you said, Brianna, a true reflection, because a lot of those times the services do live in the library because of all of the reasons you mentioned.
Thank you for clarifying that point. I think that's right. We don't know for sure exactly where the results come from, but I would want to know, because there could be a bias there. One thing I really appreciated, apart from how well organized and outlined the study was that they, in their discussion, brought up some limitations that they saw with their own study, which I feel like it would be nice to see more often. There's always limitations to any research study. In particular, they mentioned that one of their limitations is going to be potential representativeness of the American higher education landscape. And the second was that there's a potential confirmation bias in some of the survey items. So in particular, they did not include a unsure option when describing available RDM services at the institutions. And so this could have resulted in confirmation bias because it required that somebody either knew or did not know that a service existed. And I think it's really common. I know one of the hardest things we deal with here at a large research institution is making sure folks are aware of our services, and often they're not aware. And so if their only option is to put yes or no, you might have more no's or more yeses than you would anticipate getting from a general population.
Yeah, and that was actually one of their points in their discussion, which I agree. I actually like their entire discussion section. I thought it was very thoughtfully written and covered a lot of bases to wrap this all up nicely. And in that, they mentioned that, you know, just the availability of RDM services are really showing that significant association with their researchers' ability to produce open data. And their interpretation was that when an institution has invested and created these services, faculty then have more confidence and belief in the importance of sharing data and research. And this is really good. And they mentioned this too, so not all of my own words, but this is really good to not only support good practices at an institution, but also they highlight really helps in an advocacy role for the libraries where, you know, raising this awareness of open data and the services that provide it can make it easier to get services like this green lighted and, you know, supported at their institution, which I think is a really good takeaway for data professionals in general, like the ability to say like, hey, these services exist and it can help our researchers create more open data. And they actually have the stats to back that up.
Also interesting in light of how many national policies are kind of putting the onus on institutions to support their researchers, and it's showing that the method actually does work. I know I was just looking at, they're now publicly available in Canada, the tri-agencies require that all institutions have an institutional strategy for RDM prior to their policies for research data management actually going into effect. My understanding is that that was one of the first phases. And I think that is a really interesting model because all those institutions now have to have a living plan for how they're going to support their researchers with RDM. Flipping back to, I want to mention their last limitation that they mentioned is that they did not look at motivational aspects for sharing research and producing open data. And they mentioned that these motivations could be things like promotion, incentives, grant requirements, et cetera. And so that could be a potential future research study that might be interesting to look at.
Yeah, and I think that's an interesting point, that the motivations that they didn't quite have the space to look at here could also be a really big influence on those results, in addition to whether or not those services are even available.
We hope you enjoyed this article review and that you'll take a look. And we will see you next month with an interview.
Thanks for joining us, folks. We hope you enjoyed this episode of IDEA.
You can find the resources from today's show in the show notes.
Our theme music is by Scott Holmes. And a big thanks to the Research Data Alliance Interest Group, Engaging Researchers with Data, for supporting our work.
If you enjoyed the show, don't forget to rate or review us wherever you get your podcasts. We'll see you next time.